Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is taking his health care reform message on the road today. He's speaking at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, which the president has cited as a model of excellence in health care delivery. But so far, the head of the Cleveland Clinic hasn't returned any compliments of the president's health care proposals. Wall Street Journal reporter Vanessa Fermans writes about the Cleveland Clinic today. And can you tell us, Vanessa, why has the president chosen to give his address at the Cleveland Clinic?
Well, in the last couple of months, he has mentioned the Cleveland Clinic as well as the Mayo Clinic quite often. It's in reference to a study called the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare. This is a 30-year running study that's been looking at regional disparities in healthcare costs. And when you stack up the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic against other preeminent medical centers around the country, they do pretty well in healthcare costs, even though they're delivering pretty high quality care.
And specifically, we know that the clinic sees about 3 million patients a year from around the world. It's a huge enterprise. Why has it been able to deliver care so successfully?
Well, it's modeled or organized a bit differently than a lot of classic community hospitals or even academic research centers. It's what's known in healthcare as a multi-specialty group, and it's organized along teams of doctors that are specialists where they're all consulting and collaborating with each other on the patient, the diagnosis, the treatment. The other big thing is that they are employed by the clinic. They get their salary, a fixed salary from the hospital. So a lot of policy experts say that removes this incentive to over-order tests or overdo procedures. It's more based on the quality of care versus the volume of care.
And is that easy to replicate in other areas? I mean, why wouldn't it have been done already?
Well, the big thing is the way our payment system works, and that's largely driven by the Medicare payment system. The Medicare payment system, and private insurers have more or less followed suit on this, is basically a fee-for-service system when it comes to paying doctors. And that means that doctors are paid more by how much they do to patients for each test and procedure rather than the outcomes or the results. And a lot of people see this as a stumbling block to why we can't do more care in the way that the president is saying or touting the Cleveland Clinic.
Now, it's interesting that the president will also hold a closed meeting with the head of the Cleveland Clinic today, who has not commented directly on the health care plan, but his colleague, you mentioned the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, his colleague has said that he does not support the health care overhaul plan that's come forward so far. So what does it mean that a similar institution to the Cleveland Clinic has been critical of the plan and certainly critical of the idea of a government-run plan? And what are we likely expected to hear from the head of the Cleveland Clinic?
Well, I should add that the Mayo Clinic has not said that they oppose this bill. They like a lot of things that are in the bill, but their argument is that the bill perhaps doesn't do enough to overhaul the payment system to create the incentives that would produce more quality care, that would prod doctors and hospitals to deliver care that's based more on results rather than volume. So a lot of multi-specialty clinics actually have weighed in on the same comment over the last week since the House bill was presented. The Cleveland Clinic executive, Delos Cosgrove, has actually, as you said, not said anything. I think he's reserving comment. I think a lot of hospitals, as well as the Cleveland Clinic, are also still holding back because they want to see, in the end, how the bills affect hospitals, and that means Medicare, Medicaid payments, the payments that they receive for charity care.
How important is it for people like the head of the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic to support President Obama's health care plans?
It's fairly important. I mean, these are seen as the good guys in health care. So when you saw that the Mayo Clinic came out with some criticism of the bill, the Republicans really jumped on that statement more than a lot of the other comments from other stakeholders in the system, say the health insurers or the drug companies. When you see the Mayo Clinic saying something like this, people pay attention a little more.
Vanessa Fermans with the Wall Street Journal, who's been writing about President Obama's speech at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio today on health care reform. Vanessa, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The California budget agreement this week cuts funding for higher education by about 20%. On the heels of that, the state university system, which is the nation's largest, approved a 20% student fee hike and says faculty and staff, even university presidents, will be furloughed 2 days each month. On the other side of the ledger, President Obama recently announced a $12 billion program to boost the nation's community colleges. So, what is the state of American higher education, and what does the future hold? Robert Zemsky is a prominent voice in this debate. He's a professor and chair of the Learning Alliance at the University of Pennsylvania. His upcoming book is titled Making Reform Work, The Case for Transforming American Higher Education. And he joins us in the studio. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
The situation that's been happening in California, do you think that this is just an economic situation, or does it carry a sign of what people in higher education should take note of?
Well, you don't know this. I'm actually a Californian. It's really sad to watch what's happening out there. I think UC, which has been, you know, one of the great magnets of American higher education, is going to be less. People will stop moving to California, but from a California point of view, that's not a bad idea. And I think that we all will watch to see whether California really does something interesting or simply bleeds. They really need, like all of higher education, they need to change how they do business. And it's now or never for them.
What do they need to do something interesting, to make sure that they don't just bleed? And what, you know, what lesson could be taken, do you think, to try to reform things there and then could be taken broader across the country?
Well, if I was really running California, what I would do tomorrow is say we're going to have 3-year baccalaureate degrees. And that essentially would reduce by 25% the cost to the student. The universities would have less money, but it would force them to rethink all of their functions. I like to talk about higher ed as a kind of petrified forest, which has been frozen in time. This would force the unfreezing. You would teach differently. You would teach different things. You would assign different responsibilities to the community colleges versus the university system. And people would not be able to sort of say, well, I'll hold my breath. You know, what the famous line in higher ed is, this too will pass like kidney stones. And, you know, I think this one's not going to pass like that. And it can either do real damage to the system. And if I was a betting man, I'd say it's more likely to do real damage. If I'm an optimist, I would say they've got really smart people out there. This is the moment to rethink how you do it. How you use technology, how you use distance learning, when is it important to put people in the same room, not to put people in the same room, how to use high school better. You know, we all know that the senior year in high school, particularly for pretty smart kids, is a waste. And if California starts to rethink, the rest of us will start to rethink.
So you think this 3-year baccalaureate model could be a model for the nation, not just...
Oh, I do believe that. I think way past due. Almost everybody else has gone to a 3-year degree. Lots of evidence that with higher education now being a 7 or 8 year education, no reason that the baccalaureate has to be 4 years. And then we so mess it up that it's not a 4-year degree, but it's a 5 or 6 year degree because we have such complicated requirements that it takes them extra time to meet. There's a kind of history that we know in higher ed that, well, we'll change institutions one at a time. That turns out not to work in this case. We're going to have to change the whole system simultaneously.
And it would be in part this 3-year program. And I just want to go back to this because I think it's a very provocative idea to do a 3-year baccalaureate program, because I also think that that will trickle down. And then high schools would then be required to make sure that those students are even better prepared for college, which we know is an issue right now.
I get into big trouble because I regularly write that the issue with access is not affordability, it's preparation. And it would really focus real attention on not just high school, on middle years. You know, the sort of thing never talked about, but if you look at the data, it says you look at a youngster in middle school, you pretty well know what that youngster is going to look like by the time they get to college. And if you don't make the change in middle school, you're already behind the eight ball for making the change. But the other thing that will change, I think, is the role of the community colleges, which if you talk to a really clever community college president, they will say something like, well, remediation is my business. But then they have to stop because there are all kinds of crazy rules in federal student aid that you don't get your aid for remediation. So they have to call it something else. I think we'd clean up all of that. We'd really understand that we owe it to youngsters who didn't make it and get prepared in high school the second chance to do it in community college. Give them the student aid they need.
And what about if we go from community college to four-year colleges for the most part? I know that the president also said that he wants the United States to lead the world in the number of graduates by 2020. Do you think we can do that?
Not if we don't change the system. Mm-hmm. Speeches don't change anything in this business. And if you're president of the United States, you actually have $100 billion every year at play. That's roughly what the federal student aid bill is. So if you were to spend that $100 billion differently, you could re-engineer the system.
Spend it differently how? You're not saying reduce aid.
No, but, well, you might reduce aid in some odd ways. Right now, one of the things that pumps up this market is all of the loan subsidies. This is a very strange market that you talk about. One of the few markets that I know of where competition raises prices instead of lowers prices because everybody wants the latest. So you have this long history. If you look at all of the data for college enrollments over the last 30 years, everybody's shopping up. One of the reasons you can is because the federal government, both directly and indirectly, has made enormous loan funds available to do that. So one possibility is to rethink how do people actually pay for college education? Now, there are lots of clever ideas out there. One of them is, well, what would happen if we actually gave somebody a fund when they were in the sixth grade so that as a sixth grader, you now had, say, $10,000 in the bank that could only be spent if you went to college? That would change your motivation, would do lots of things. The fund would grow. You know, it's sort of like privatizing Social Security, but doing it not for the old, but for the young, which is a much more interesting idea. So that the whole way that the aid system worked would not be sort of, we'll send you a check when you're ready to go to college, but we will help you build a savings fund. And in fact, we'll put a lot of the money into that savings fund at the front end. And those funds are only available to you if you go to college. So you would essentially turn the thing upside down, not the money at the end of the chain, but the money at the beginning of the chain.
Robert Zamsky is professor and chair of the Learning Alliance at the University of Pennsylvania. By the way, there are a handful of colleges that are offering three-year baccalaureate degrees, including Southern New Hampshire University and Southern Oregon University. But there are also some who argue that the bachelor's degree is so obsolete, no matter how long it takes to earn. Our conversation on higher education continues after a break. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Robert Zamsky, chair of the Learning Alliance at the University of Pennsylvania. Before the break, Professor, you were talking about this concept of people shopping up for a college education, going to the most prestigious schools regardless of how much they cost. And even with the recession and most tuition between $40,000 and $50,000 a year, you say that will continue because people essentially believe they're buying prestige?
Yeah, they will make their private solutions. And their private solutions for their children is price matters, so I will go up the scale. I mean, you would have thought for 30 years we've been having this conversation about the upward price that people would start trying the low-cost spread. They just haven't. You want an institution in trouble? Find an institution that's low-cost. That's the institution in trouble. That tells you something, that there really isn't a burning fire out there. You asked me a little while ago about the president's let's make us international leaders. Well, once we were international leaders, the rest of the world caught up and went beyond us. They've done a lot of redesigning of systems. The whole Bologna process in Europe is a redesign of a system on a mammoth scale. They took 10 years to do it. They didn't want to do it in a year, which is usually our way of proceeding. But 10 years to re-engineer the system.
Can you explain the Bologna process a little bit?
Sure. Europe has got this sort of funny problem. They've been all these independent nation states forever. And yet they actually created a common labor market and discovered if you're going to have a common labor market, you better have a common education market. So they had to find a way of standardizing higher ed across all the countries in the European Union. That, and it started in Bologna, so it's known as the Bologna process. They actually just did what we've done. You know, if you get a degree in Boston, it's good in Arizona. But now if you get a degree in Czechoslovakia, it's good in Italy, and it wasn't before. But it's a lot of reengineering and a lot of saying it's going to be 3 years, here are the standards, here are the processes by which you determine whether you're meeting your goals or not. Right now, we fly blind. My father was a physician. I used to accompany him on rounds in the hospital. So you would always stop at the nurse's station, and you would pick up every patient's chart. I've often thought of that image, that my father wouldn't walk into a room, even though he knew the patient really well, without checking that chart. I walk into classrooms every day of my life, and I have no idea who I'm dealing with, unless over time I get to know them. There's no chart. There's no equivalent sort of sense. This student learns this way. This student learns a different way. This student's having trouble. This student's doing okay. But just imagine if we sort of said to those of us who are faculty members, really learn the population you're dealing with. And by the way, we will build measurement tools and information tools to help you. We've done none of that. The rest of the world has, or businesses have had all of that revolution. Higher ed, we haven't had it at all.
So higher ed isn't focusing on learning?
No, not really. Of course not. But it focuses on teaching. You know, that there's this really terrible debate about is it teaching or learning? And faculty members do care about their teaching. And we think we care about learning. We just don't know whether our students are learning or not.
I'd like to just go back to the federal aid question for a minute, because I think that one is one that will really get people's ears perking up. When you talk about rejiggering the whole aid process and possibly focusing on younger kids and creating savings accounts for these kids, I think that it's interesting to me that how would you almost stop the moving train, really, and change the system for those kids who are at the age where they're going through it right now. You would have to protect aid for them, obviously, so they would still be able to afford to go to school while you're at the same time creating something for younger kids that might make them make more fiscally responsible decisions in their higher education later on.
That's easy. See, we now live in a world where we do the accounting differently, thanks to TARP and all of these other devices. So what you would do, actually, with the Congressional Budget Office is you would demonstrate that, yes, in the short run, there would be higher levels of federal outlay because you'd be carrying two populations. That's what you're really saying to me. If you're going to start them in sixth grade, what are you going to do with the kid in 11th grade?
Right, okay. Right.
So for a while, you actually have to carry both. But in the long run, the money evens out. So you would have an accounting device. We've gotten very good at accounting devices that says we're not really spending more money. We're just spending more money now.
What about the rankings? Are those contributing to this problem, do you think?
Sure. But contributing makes it sound like they caused it. What the people who've done the rankings have figured out is somebody ready to pay $40,000 is ready to pay $5 for a magazine that gives them some extra information. So, no, it's the willingness to pay $50,000 that is the real drive here. And it just feeds on itself. So for $50,000, you want famous professors. Well, famous professors cost money. You want amenities. Amenities cost money. And it just drives on itself.
Is there a university right now that you think is taking steps to make itself more in line with your redesigned model?
We're actually working with the university at the Learning Alliance at the University of New Hampshire. And I keep pushing back at them and I say, come on, are you serious or are you just talking to me because I'm here? And they say, no, they're serious. So there's one. I think a lot of these sort of public universities. They're not going to get more money from their state legislatures. They're going to have some price constraints on them. And they're going to really look for ways for distinguishing themselves. So I think if I was to look for places, it would be these smaller public universities. New Hampshire's one, UVM, Vermont is one, Delaware is another. I don't think we're going to get them out of the mega Western universities, although the University of Washington has some history of doing interesting things. The problem is that in the end, does being different pay? And that's what the market has taught us. No, being different doesn't pay. Being prestigious pays.
Robert Zemsky is a professor and chair of the Learning Alliance at the University of Pennsylvania. His upcoming book is titled Making Reform Work, The Case for Transforming American Higher Education. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, as a U.S. soldier kidnapped in Afghanistan remains held hostage by a Taliban terrorist group, we'll talk with a British TV journalist about what it was like for him when he was kidnapped in Pakistan and held for 3 months by the same group. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, spicy music that inspires kids to eat healthy food. This week, quantum physicists, philosophers, and rappers are among the speakers at the TED Global Ideas Conference in England. The theme is the substance of things not seen. So the Radio Science Orchestra is demonstrating with space-controlled musical instruments. Those are instruments played without touching them. The BBC's James Fletcher went to a rehearsal.
5, 4...
When Neil Armstrong boarded Apollo 11 40 years ago on his historic mission to the moon, he took with him a tape of theremin music.
Very nice.
Before Armstrong made his giant leap, the idea of setting foot on another planet had been the realm of science fiction. And when sci-fi movies wanted to evoke the sound of unknown worlds, the instrument they often turned to was the theremin. It was invented in 1920 by Leon Theremin, whose great-niece, Lydia Kavanagh, is a master of the instrument.
Theremin's a very strange instrument. It doesn't look like any musical instrument at all. It has two antennas and no strings or no keys. And I play without any touching this instrument. It works with the electromagnetic field that's around these antennas. And with my right hand, I'm changing the tune. So closer to the antenna is the tune higher, and back from the antenna is the tune lower. So that's the way I play the melody. The instrument was invented in Russia. That's why I play a Russian song for you.
It's a strange sight watching Lydia make music by sliding, swirling, and vibrating her hands in thin air. And she doesn't only play Russian melodies. Lydia Kavanagh is a member of the Radio Science Orchestra. They've gathered in a rehearsal studio on the outskirts of London, and the five members have brought with them an eclectic range of instruments. As well as theremin, there's an orchestral harp, laptop computers, and banks of analogue synthesizers. Bruce Woolley is one of the founders of the group.
It's an ensemble which bases itself around the theremin and a theory of space-controlled music. In other words, you manipulate the space in front of you and you don't actually touch frets or keys or strings. You just move your hands in air.
If the theremin is the grandmother of space-controlled instruments, then the brash new kid on the block is the beams.
The beams uses six lasers, which can be assigned to different notes, different events, and so on.
The picture in your head right now might be of a heavy metal headbanger with a guitar around his knees, but Bruce actually looks more like a Shaolin monk, karate chopping a field of laser beams to trigger the samples of distorted guitar. The heavy metal patch won't be turning up at any concerts, though. It's strictly for impressing visitors.
Yeah.
The group run through the theme to Doctor Who. It's a classic sci-fi tune, but it makes me wonder if the theremin has become retro, trapped in the sci-fi visions of the past. I ask Bruce Woolley if the band's analogue technology still has the power to create fresh visions of the future.
The reason that a theremin brings to mind the cosmos or science fiction isn't just because we've been coded through Hollywood. It's actually because those sounds are reaching levels which digital signals simply don't. Theremin, Moog, these are infinite instruments indeed.
So food for thought for the Radio Science Orchestra's audiences. And maybe, just maybe, a glimpse of what was on Neil Armstrong's mind as he packed his theremin tape for that famous voyage into the infinite.
That report from the BBC's James Fletcher. We'll be back after a quick break with what do consumers say about cutting healthcare costs. It's Here and Now. Question. If you could design a healthcare system and decide which medical procedures would be covered, which ones would you choose? An inhaler for a 9-year-old with asthma? Hip replacement for a 72-year-old? What about expensive acne medication for a teen? As Washington debates healthcare reform and containing health spending, we're looking today at what Americans are willing to do without. The nonpartisan Center for Healthcare Decisions conducted a series of phone surveys and group discussions and asked people what matters most in healthcare. Marge Ginsburg is the group's executive director, and she joins us from the studios of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. And Marge, tell us about the survey and what you found.
What we did with this phone survey is everyone received 9 vignettes, short 2-sentence descriptions of a medical problem or a treatment. And there were a number of things that more than 90% of people agreed, yes, it should be covered. Let me give you an example of one of them. Though she was careful about avoiding the sun, a 48-year-old woman learned that she has skin cancer. She has a good chance of being cured if she gets chemotherapy for several months. 96% approved this for coverage. So we went through all these 80-some vignettes, and the types of situations that almost everyone agreed on were things that saved lives, that enables productive functioning, that prevents new illness, that controls pain, and that produces good results. So these really weren't the ones that were controversial.
So let's go back to this 48-year-old skin cancer woman here for a moment. If it had said that the chemotherapy probably would have no effect on whether she lived any longer, would you have gotten a different answer?
Absolutely, we'd get a different answer, because a number of the vignettes we used, in fact, incorporated questions about treatment effectiveness. And when we did that, we saw that the approval for coverage fell off dramatically. So people did pay very close attention to whether they thought treatment was going to be effective or not.
One of the more controversial vignettes involved breast reconstruction surgery, and you asked people if they would pay for the surgery for a 55-year-old woman with breast cancer, even though a bra insert would give her a normal-looking figure. She wanted an artificial breast. How did they respond?
What was interesting about this is on the phone survey, 81% approved it for coverage, which is fairly high, not among the highest. We brought this one to the discussion groups, and we got far more controversy on this than we were expecting. Some folks who really didn't think that this should be part of a basic health plan would say things like, it's basically cosmetic surgery, that if she's been cured by cancer, we don't really need to go the extra step and help her feel whole again. An artificial breast really has no function. In fact, someone made an interesting statement, which I'll quote, we're not talking self-esteem insurance, we're talking health insurance. And that's what a lot of people said who supported it, is that women need this for their self-esteem and that we really owe it to her. So even something that probably many people haven't thought much about really raises a lot of questions in people's minds about what is the essence of health insurance and how far should we go to make people feel good about themselves.
I'm wondering how that may have translated into then coverage for things like mental health.
The mental health problems that were most dramatic, most severe, that people understood, they covered those just as strongly as they did any other physical health problem that would impair someone's ability to function normally. Where their support tapered off is when you got to issues that clearly seemed less important. We had one example of a couple that wanted marriage counseling, and most people did not think that was important enough to be covered. So people have some pretty strong views about what constitutes a problem versus those that they think really belong in the realm of personal responsibility.
You know, in one of the vignettes in your survey, a 12-year-old boy is 30 pounds overweight, and then the decision that folks had to make was whether insurance should pay for medically supervised nutrition and exercise. What did folks say about that?
People looked at this from two different angles. On the one side is a strong feeling most people have that it is the responsibility of the parents to make sure that their child is eating well, is exercising well. It's not the responsibility of society to step in and make those changes that they can make on their own. But the people who thought it really should be covered were looking at it from the angle of, first of all, this was a young boy, 12-year-old, and they were very worried that if he's at this pattern now in his age, that there's no telling what his health is going to be like 10 years from now. So they really thought, you know, the parents can't handle it clearly, and there's a point at which we need to step in and offer some help to mitigate these problems before they turn into really serious health problems.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about how to rein in health care costs as Congress considers this whole health care overhaul, and some folks say one way to do it is to look at whether there are a lot of unnecessary tests. And you have a scenario in your survey where a 40-year-old man says he wants to get an expensive test that would detect a potential heart problem, even though he has no symptoms. And in your study, that procedure got a lower rating overall, but still 55% of the people involved approved it. So what does that say?
That raises another interesting issue, because in fact, of all these vignettes, very few actually fell below the 50% mark for approval. So you can look at it two ways. You can say, wow, it must mean no matter how unnecessary things are, people want them anyway. How we decided to interpret this is that when people were doing this phone survey, they weren't told that they had a limited amount of money to spend. They weren't told that they could only approve half of the vignettes they were given. So we're interpreting it as we are getting there. People are beginning to see that perhaps just because someone wants something doesn't justify it being paid for through communal funding.
But don't you also run the risk of perhaps with something that may not be as well proven as another type of medical procedure, affording coverage to that particular procedure because of its unproven track record? And actually, that could be a very good preventive tool that would end up saving you money in the long run.
Most of the time, the public is not aware of how much is being done that, in fact, there is very little evidence, if any, that it works. They assume that anything that their doctor prescribes is being prescribed because it has been proven to work. When you ask people to come together as a group and figure out what is fair, what is reasonable, what are the rules by which we can all live and feel good about it, they are much more willing to say, no, we need to wait and make sure something really works well before we invest hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, down a road that leads nowhere.
And what happens with your study from here?
Well, in terms of how this might be used for what's happening in Washington now, they're not really talking about benefits design just yet. Eventually, we're hoping that this might be a model to policymakers that bring the public into the discussion.
Marge Ginsburg is executive director of the Center for Healthcare Decisions. For more information about her group's report titled What Matters Most, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Marge, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in a minute with world music about food for kids. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Take some advice to kids about healthy eating, add a spice of world music flavor, and you'll get something that sounds like this.
Mes parents sont bio, 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 ne mangent que du bio, 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 ne boivent que du bio, 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 ne jurent que par bio. Chez nous, tout est bio.
This song, Mes Parents Sont Bio, or My Parents Are Organic, is by Pascal Parisot. And it's from Putumayo Kids' new CD, Picnic Playground. Putumayo Kids is a world music label for children that has sold 3 million CDs in more than 100 countries and is now celebrating its 10th anniversary. Putumayo Kids founder, CEO, and world traveler Dan Storber joins us from New York with more. Welcome, Dan.
Great to be here.
Also joining us from New York is one of Putumayo's featured artists, Jose Conde. Welcome, Jose.
It's a pleasure.
Dan, let's start with you first. How did Putumayo get started and get into kids' music?
Well, you know, I had been doing a series of compilations since Putumayo World Music began in 1993. And I have a lot of friends who had young kids, and they were saying that kids love the music, but they thought it would be great if we could just do a CD that focused on kid-friendly music. It didn't have to be kid songs per se, that they could also enjoy. So the first CD, World Playground, came out in 93, and we've just continued along that line.
And why food this time around? You want to get kids to be more experimental with food, or what are you trying to do?
Well, there are a lot of great food theme songs, and we kept coming across them. And I basically tried to find a way to tie together two things that everyone loves. You know, everyone loves food and everyone loves music. So we thought songs about food for children would be an ideal way to put a CD together.
And we have a song right now that we'll take a listen to. This one's Bowl of Cherries.
Oh, Lord, I could eat a bowl of cherries. Oh, Lord, I could eat a bowl a day. Jump back, turn around, eat a bowl of cherries. Jump back, turn around, eat a bowl a day. Jump back, turn around.
And that's Bowl of Cherries by Rhythm Child. I'm wondering, Dan, what age group would you say do these types of songs primarily appeal to?
Kids, typically 2 or 3 all the way up to, say, 8 or 9 is really the core range for these songs. But I think, you know, World Playground, my co-founder, his brother is 70 years old, said his favorite Putumayo album of all time is World Playground. So I think, you know, the idea is it's music for people of all ages, but it's focused for kids, certainly.
Right. You may as well not have the parents hate the kids' music their whole lives, right? So have enough of that when they get to be teenagers.
Exactly.
That's the way it works. Jose, you're a Cuban-American, and on this CD, you and your group, Ola Fresca, have a song about a Cuban delicacy. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Arroz con pollo en bolas, bolitas de arroz con pollo. Arroz con pollo en bolas, bolitas de arroz con pollo.
So, Jose, chicken and yellow rice balls. Tell us, why did you choose this song?
Well, you know, it was the most obvious for me. There is a tradition in Cuban music of a lot of food tunes. And I love the mambo. It's a great thing. I would love to see the mambo age come back into fashion. We recorded this, in a sense, as a homage to the mambo. And, you know, I hope they enjoy the song. I hope they think it's playful. And somehow, you know, are encouraged to find some more mambo out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear another song. This one is called Milch, meaning milk.
Ich hab ein Tier zum Freund und das ist total lieb. Es ist eine Kuh und ich bin froh, dass es sie gibt. Immer wenn sie bei mir ist, bekomme ich Appetit. Aber nicht auf meine Kuh, sondern auf das, was sie mir gibt. Ich melk mich, das ist klasse.
What about the language? You know, how do you think it may be different for children? Are they not really affected at all by the fact that there are several different languages? They don't necessarily know what they're talking about. It's just sort of catchy?
Yeah, well, I think kids respond, I think, first and foremost to the beat, the melody, they really often at the age of 3, 4, or 5, you know, are not catching the drift of a lot of the words. And so music in foreign languages with a beat and rhythm that makes them feel good and jump up and down and, you know, dance, or even just, you know, makes them happy. You see it. I have a 4-year-old, and I'd put some of these Putumayo songs on just to see how he responds. And you just see that his face light up. He'll start dancing. And if he doesn't like a song, then he'll also express that by either boredom or, you know, next one, Dad, go back to the previous one. So I think the idea, you know, Picnic Playground is one of those albums that we really put together with the goal of having kids love it and adults love it. Mm-hmm. Also with the food theme, most of these songs are about healthy eating. We ended it with the cookies and milk songs. But basically, you know, the goal is to try and get kids to learn about the world through music, and food is a big part of the world.
Well, let's listen to one song that's really entertaining. This one's Ice Cream, and it's from Trinidad.
Coconut, mango, chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, tangerine, babadine, banana, guava, pineapple, sour, sap, and kiwi. Peanut, raisin, prunes, and dates. All kind of flavors for you now to taste. Ice cream, you scream. Everybody screaming. Ice cream. Ice cream. Ice cream.
Now, Jose, you can hear the song's very fun. It's very playful. Do you have to play differently and get a little bit more playful when you're dealing with a younger audience?
I really try to connect with the children. Children have shorter attention spans, so when you are in front of them live, what you try to do is try to integrate them, speak to them, tell them a little bit about the music, get an instrument in their hands, get them up on stage. You know, I don't think you play differently, but you really have to figure out a way to integrate them into the action on stage.
Mm-hmm. So almost teach them a little bit as well.
Yeah, teach them without, you know, without letting them know that they're being taught. Because you don't want to be too front and center. They'll rebel.
Right. That's always the trick. But Dan, you know, some people might be listening and they might be thinking an entire label for world music for young children. It seems like we've come a long way in a very short period of time. Wasn't Barney the Purple Dinosaur around just about a decade ago or so? And now, you know, this is a big jump here in not all that long a period of time, isn't it?
I think we've come a tremendously long way in the last 10 or 15 years. You know, there's so much great music in the world, and a lot of it doesn't get played on radio or on television. I keep waiting for those, you know, Latin and African songs to break through on commercial radio. But, you know, certainly we've taken great strides since, you know, kind of an English-only approach to music for kids.
Putumayo Kids founder Dan Storper and Jose Conde of Ola Fresca. They've been talking with us about Putumayo Kids Presents Picnic Playground. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we leave you with some music from South Africa. This is Beautiful Day. Both Jose Conde and Putumayo Picnic Playground are on tour this summer. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Come try my papaya. Since I'm sitting on bamboo, I'm gonna get me one of those too. It's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day to be down by the water with a blanket on the sand. I'm trying to sober no day. I'm trying to sober no day. No good time any longer. Na bangani, na bondeni. I'm trying to solve it all day. I'm trying to solve it all day. No good time any longer. All right, then I'm gonna need a bomb. It's a beautiful day.